The Handy is the first sex toy that's ever made me feel like there's a sure thing in the bottom drawer. If you have a dick, you need this. And we've got a new promo code, so listen up. Use code BILLYVALENTINE21 for a $15 voucher to add an accessory to your bag at thehandy.com. The Man Whore Podcast is sponsored by Alt Playground. APG is more than just a place to find couples to swap with. Alt Playground is a lifestyle community for all non-monogamous and sexually adventurous people to connect and share. And you know I started a profile. Join me over at altplayground.net. That's altplayground.net. Hotmovies.com has long been an ethical and affordable place to hashtag pay for some of your porn. Now with Hot Movies Select, customers gain access to unlimited viewings of tens of thousands of additional films from all their favorite studios for the low, low price of $24.95. Visit hotmovies.com, click Select Unlimited, and use promo code MANWHORE at checkout so they know who sent you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now let's get to the show.
Welcome to the Man Whore Podcast.
Oh my God, please stop tweeting about WandaVision until I can catch up. This is Billy Procida, and you are listening to the Man Whore Podcast. Hey, hey, hi, hi, hello. Normally I say little cutesy wootsy slutty butt stuff up top. Not today, because I'm dodging spoilers left and right on the internet. I'm surprised I'm opening my phone at all till I get an opportunity. Billy, why haven't you caught up yet? Because I'm scared of my roommate, okay? She's like 5 foot nothing. She weighs nothing pounds, and she's terrifying. Get to my roommate in a moment. I did not plan on saying that, but that's what came out of my face in the safety of my car. Billy, why are you recording your car right now? Because I'm terrified of my tiny little fucking roommate. She's a goddamn child, and she's scary. Anyways, this week on the show, everyone, I have a totally not scary human being, Dr. Kristen Mark. She is a sex and dating researcher. She actually works with Dr. Justin Lee Miller on that study that we discussed when he was on the show last month. We'll get into that in a little bit. But first, oh my God, my fucking roommate. Look, I'm just trying to say, it is terrifying for someone to gaslight me, staring me in the eyes, like staring me in the eyes and acting like, I have no idea why you're perturbed right now, Billy. I have no idea. I'm only hiding shit you use on a daily basis from in the kitchen in places you don't think they're going to be, even after you asked me directly not to put them in that cupboard. Well, I don't know. Why are you upset? I don't get it. I think maybe then you have a problem. She's studying to be a therapist, which is terrifying to me. Because I think she's just going to become like a fucking Gone Girl character. She's going to be like, if she's a sociopath, I wouldn't be surprised. It's like 5 more months and then I can, like, you know, put an ad out for a clothing optional roommate who doesn't mind if they can hear me create OnlyFans content. Sound like a pleasant place to live? Oi. Oi. But some good news. Here's a positive thing we can all be happy about. Billy Boy here shot right in the fucking arm. Yeah, stick it in my fatty pig arm, Daddy Cuomo. I want my shot. We'll talk about BMI later. Yeah, nothing went wrong. Got the shot. Everything was fine. No, I mean, it was too fine. You know, I'm going in there and they're asking about my jobs and I'm like, well, I don't know. I do not have any of those noble professions that we have deemed worthy of an early vaccine shot. No, I'm not a first responder. I'm not a frontline worker. I'm not a state employee. I said to them, underlying physical condition, And I was waiting for them to be like, in which condition? Then I would have said obesity. And they would say, like, Mr. Presida, like, that can't possibly be right. Look at you. You look stunning. And I would be like, oh, gosh, thank you so much. You should follow my free OnlyFans. But I actually did the calculation, and I am, in fact, a BMI of about 32 and a half, 33. And then they would be like, no, I don't believe that. I just don't. It's probably all muscle. And you know what? That whole BMI system's outdated, Billy. I hope you feel all right. You're looking good. And I'd be like, I could be obese and looking good, but thank you. I appreciate it. Now, can I get my goddamn shot? But no, I said obese. And then they're like, okay, cool. You could roll your sleeve up. It's like, you could like try a little bit, but it's okay, 'cause I got my vaccine. Ah! I'm so excited to make out with people responsibly. Who wants to make out? So that's cool. That's exciting. And like, arrangements are being made. And I swear to God, after I got the shot, I was thinking, man whore con, bitches. I hear the news. They say, pretty much all adults will have the opportunity to have a shot by the end of July or August, which I think, because the previous administration was so like trying to be rosy about it, I feel like they are purposefully just setting the bar low, knowing they're going to hurdle the fuck out of it as like company after company gets their vaccines approved. So I think it should be faster than that if they get enough people to, you know, not just enough vaccines, but enough vaccinators. So I don't see a reason why ManwhoreCon doesn't happen in August or September. Maybe more like a September, give everyone enough time to plan. But Jesus, how much time do you need to actually plan something right now? Have we all not been just biting at the bits? So unofficially, ManwhoreCon, it's going to be fucking on. And unless you've got a real medical excuse not to, get your fucking shot so you can join us. What is it going to be? Going to be different than before, probably what I proposed last year, back when we cutely thought this would all last a few months. I'm thinking upstate New York, somewhere in New York State, get like a big cabin, like a big ass Airbnb, and just have a fucking weekend with each other. When ManwhoreCon rolls around, we tend to have a pretty good time, and usually at some point my dick comes out. Like, it's requested. I don't just like whip it out for no reason. So, you know, stay tuned for all that. If you don't want to miss news on ManwhoreCon, maybe you're not able to listen to each episode as they come out. I'm telling you, there's been no better time to be on my mailing list so that you do not miss such exciting announcements. Most likely ManwhoreCon this year will have a very limited capacity, right? So go to manwhorepod.com, sign up for the mailing list. You'll thank me later. I made a couple podcast appearances that were really fun, so I want to just quickly share. I was on my friend Celie Schumer's show, Still Got It. It's a movie podcast where we go back to some throwback films, see if they hold up. We did Catch Me If You Can. Check that one out if you want to know how I feel about it. And then I returned for the three-peat on my buddy David Piccolomini's show, Tinder Tales. I just was on the latest episode of that. We talked a lot about the OnlyFans and the glory hole action. And then this spot right here was actually a spot where we were going to have a segment with sex talker Ashley Cobb. Ashley Cobb is the host of the Ho and Tell podcast, as well as the upcoming Sex with Ashley podcast. But almost 7 years doing this, first time it's happened, but we actually recorded at different speeds. She was recording at a video speed. So when she sent me her side of the track, they didn't line up because hers was faster. So we had to, it was also going to be a bonus episode for Patreon. So patrons, I'm sorry, tomorrow you're not getting this bonus show that I had, that we recorded. But we were talking about celebrity sex gossip. I filled her in on Armie Hammer, who she kept referring to as Arm and Hammer because she didn't know who he was. And I won't blame her. But I did want to still give Ashley a plug. If you're looking for a sex storytelling podcast or another sex storytelling podcast, Ho and Tell is her show. And she invites people to anonymously share their hoey sex stories. So you can check that out and go check out Ashley Cobb on all the socials. We had fun. Hope to have her on maybe later this year. Before I get to this week's guest, Dr. Kristen Mark, let's do a real quick fan whore appreciation moment. Today it's going to be for Andy, the One Day Wonder. Thank you for sliding into my DMs on Instagram, and then I like slightly pressured you that you should join the Patreon, and then you gave me $10, but then you bounced like immediately. Hey, I'm appreciate it, but stick around, hang, play a while. But nah, man, you just stuffed money down my pants and ran off. I feel almost used. If my greatest fantasy in the world wasn't to be just a giant whore, I'd be offended. But I am one, so thank you, Andy, for being a very brief member of our fan whore community on Patreon. And you too can join us and support the podcast that you love. People were like, Billy, how'd you hold up during the pandemic? And I said, Patreon, everybody. Without the Patreon, don't know what would have happened. I probably would have had to start looking into donating semen. I hear that's a thing you can do. But I didn't have to do that scramble because my listeners got my back and I'm very grateful for it. But luckily I was able to commit all my time and energy to making y'all awesome content and giving my Patreon community really fun bonuses and extras and behind the scenes content. So join us today for as little as $2 at patreon.com/manwhorepodcast. Yes, for just $2, you can support a whore with a heart of gold. One more time, that's Patreon, patreon.com/manwhorepodcast. And now for this week's guest, you know, oh, she's a fucking terror. Dr. Kristen Mark is my guest this week. I'm doing this in the car, so that way it's just, they have a friend over that they're making dinner with. And then she was like, well, I just like, you know, when my friends are over, can you not? Because like, they can totally hear from the living room, you like recording your podcast, and it's like uncomfortable. Oh my God, you're such a square. Dr. Kristen Mark, I will introduce my guest. I will do it. And I'm going to puff up my chest and I'm going to walk right into the apartment through the side entrance where I get to avoid everybody into my basement. Oh, okay. I can't. I'm not going to do it. We're going to have a couple ad reads. And then I'm going to chit chat with Kristen. But right now I'm going to tell you that we're going to talk to Kristen. Do I sound like I'm having a breakdown? Maybe. I think I need to hit up the therapist and be like, can we schedule a one-on-one and have a talk? Oh, yeah. I probably will have to do that from my car as well. Otherwise, my roommate's just going to hear me complaining about her. Let's go chat. Let's go hear about some results on some research with the Dr. Kristen Mark. You know what's great about the handy? I can sit here recording an ad read for the handy while I'm using the handy. But am I really though? No, but seriously, this toy is so quiet, and that's why I'm so happy that they're sponsoring the Man Whore podcast this week. Look, this thing is amazing. It's going to make you wonder if like every podcast is getting a robot hand job while they work. This toy is incredible. And not only is it easy to clean and quiet to use, it hooks up to the Wi-Fi, the Wi-Fi, where a partner with your Kiko can control your handy from across the country. And that's how I know the relationship's gone serious, by the way, when we're exchanging key codes for our wireless fuck toys. Anyway, visit thehandy.com, that's thehandy.com, and use promo code BillyValentine21 for a voucher for a free accessory. That could be an extra sleeve, some lube, maybe a cock ring, who knows. Get your handy with code BillyValentine21 at thehandy.com. Yeah, I know that was a lot to remember. I got a link in the show notes with that code. I see a post-vaccine era on the horizon. I wonder who's going to be joining me over there and who's going to be joining me over at altplayground.net. Yep, because that is the only lifestyle site you're going to want to be on when that horizon arrives. To quote our esteemed friend of the pod, Andrea Allen, you're going to be fucking, you're going to be sucking. And fingering and orgy doming and squirting and dog collaring. and you'll want to connect with like-minded sluts to do it all. APG is filled with experienced lifestylers and serious newbies. Yeah, that's the thing, putting membership behind a paywall, it helps keep out the riffraff and the flakes. When you join altplayground.net, you'll find out that the members aren't playing around. So prepare for your next non-monogamous adventure at altplayground.net. Let me guess. You know you should pay for some of your porn. You know it's the right thing to do. But no one's site has all the different porn that you like. Wrong. Hotmovies.com features hundreds of thousands of videos from all your favorite porn studios, featuring all your favorite porn stars doing all your favorite porn sex stuff. And now they're introducing Hot Movies Select Unlimited, their monthly subscription service giving you unlimited viewing time and unlimited reruns for their curated library of films. Just $24.95 a month to have all the porn you could possibly need. And use promo code MANWHORE for a bonus at checkout, and so they know who sent you. Hotmovies.com. Promo code MANWHORE.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Now let's get to the show.
Super pragmatic decision around people will always have sex. There will always be reasons and questions to study. I would never run out of research questions. And it was just like fascinating. So I knew that you could be a professor. I knew you could be a researcher, although it took me a long time to learn that too, because I'm a first generation college student. So I didn't quite understand how like academia worked. Once I realized that you could do that, I was like, but it would have to be something that's like super interesting. Like I spent time, you know, talking to no disrespect to biologists at all, but you know, I would spend time like talking to a biologist who's working on this very specific cell of this very specific organism it just seemed so abstract to me as just a person in the world. And so I wanted to make sure that I was studying something that was not so abstract, like that someone
something
could
tangible that actually, like can like actually help people's lives.
Right. Something that people would understand immediately. And yes, there's nuances to it and there's depths to it that maybe I don't get into all the time, but I do get into in the science side. But it would like have an immediate impact on people's lives in a positive way that I could tangibly see, because otherwise I think it would be hard for me to continue going through like studying something if it didn't have these kind of like tangible outcomes.
Yeah, something like really kind of direct to consumer. Like, we figured this out. I can say this to you. You got it. You can go fix it. As opposed to like explaining a chemical mechanism that they're like, okay, and now what?
Right. Yeah. And all of that research is incredibly important, of course. But it just, I knew that that wouldn't be a good fit for me. And so.
So when around in your life did you go, oh, sex, there's endless questions about it. That's the direction I want to go in.
Yeah, that was probably in undergrad. I had thought that I was going to be like a forensic psychologist, but I was working at a maximum security prison and really didn't enjoy, like, the experience was wonderful, but I really didn't enjoy that, and talked to a couple forensic psychologists and felt like, you know, they sort of discouraged me, honestly, because, and so I just didn't feel like it was going to be the right fit for me. And I really wanted to work with like the most hardcore criminals, you know, the ones who have committed the most egregious crimes. And rehabilitation in the context of therapy for those folks is difficult, to put it lightly. So I shifted at that point because I was taking a human sexuality course and was like, oh, this is something you can actually do. I did not know that. And that it really exposed me to this being an option in Canada at the time, there weren't very many sex and relationships researchers. Well, there weren't very many of either. And very,
are you Canadian?
I am Canadian. Yeah.
Ah,
yeah.
I didn't
yeah.
know that. I usually try to screen y'all out, but I guess
sure.
Which is a good time to say I'm here with Dr. Kristen Mark, Hello, hello.
Hi.
Wait, I was, you know, when you're like in that transitioning like mindset, is it was part of you thinking like to marry the two things, like what you were already doing and what you had a new interest in, and think like, oh, well, what if I wanted to like study like sex crimes and sexual criminals?
That was part of my initial. So I was interested in like people who had committed, you know, multiple rapes, that kind of thing. That was my initial interest. I really like wanted to be Clarice from Silence of the Lambs, essentially. But once I learned about the fact that you could study sexuality and sex and relationships, I really was more interested in the positive side of it. So like, how do we achieve, people are really uncomfortable talking about sex. How do we get people more comfortable talking about it? Because when you feel comfortable talking about it, you tend to have more satisfying sex lives. Because if you just like brush it under the rug, then it's not going to go anywhere or develop or like be enjoyable, and sex should be enjoyable. I realized that, and also was just like, there were a lot of people doing like HIV prevention work at that time, or there were people doing like pregnancy prevention, and that's super important. But I was more interested in how do we do that and like promote healthy sexuality and promote people to be like have satisfying sex lives. Like, how do we reach that sort of self-actualization phase of one's sexual health?
It sounds like you were already pretty comfortable with the topic of sexuality.
Yeah, very comfortable talking about it. And I was always sort of like, my friends would come to me with advice or like ask me questions. Oh,
were you the sex friend?
I was the sex friend, yeah. I think so. I wonder if my friends would agree with that now. I'm still, my closest group of friends is still my friends from like kindergarten. So I am curious what they would say, but.
Were you raised in a more like sex positive household? Like, what was the attitudes about that growing up?
I think, again, it was in Canada, so it's a little bit better there sex positivity-wise than it is in the United States.
That's what I was going to ask next, by the way, if you want to expound on like the vast difference between the way Canada views sex and America.
I mean, I wouldn't call it a vast difference. Like, there's still quite a few issues in Canada related to comprehensive sexuality education and that kind of thing. It's just not consistently offered. Like, I wouldn't say that I had a comprehensive sex education in school. I had like the typical sort of like puberty talk in grade 5 or something. And then like in grade 8 or 9, we got some information maybe about condoms. I don't really remember. That's certainly not, school is not where I got my sex education. I would say I got it from like friends and media and my parents a little bit. Like, my mom had a book that I remember reading. She kind of just like left it somewhere that we could read it. So I wouldn't say like I was raised in a super sex positive household in the sense that they really talked about it a lot. But I did feel like I could go to them if I had questions. Not that I necessarily did, but they gave my brother like condoms in his stocking from probably the age of like 13 on, but like me and my sister didn't get anything. So I think that that is interesting too.
You're like, mom, right? I need condoms too.
Right. Yeah. You see like that dynamic, right? Of like preparing the boy, and not really preparing the girls as much. And so that did play out a little bit, although like I can remember my mom when she found out that I was on birth control, like she sort of made this comment. I hadn't told her about it, and she had found the birth control when she was like cleaning out the bathroom or something. And so she was putting salt on popcorn that she was making for us. And I was like, no, mom, don't put salt on it. And that was, and she just stopped and she's like, so why are you on birth control? Because she knew that the reason I was asking for
what
her
do you
to
think,
not,
mom?
The reason I was asking for her to not put salt on the popcorn was because I like heard all these myths about weight gain with like, which is, I mean, a whole other bag of worms that we can not get into today. But, you know, I think like she knew that that's why I was saying that, and that was her opening. So it's not like she felt like she could bring it up just on its own. She needed an opening for that, and she used that as the opening, and then we had the conversation about it. But
Yeah. But it doesn't sound like they instilled y'all from the get-go with a bunch of shame, which like is the like sadly low bar, I think, a parent has to clear to not sexually fuck up their kid.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I was not – I didn't see sex as like shameful. I didn't see like masturbation as shameful. We didn't – I didn't grow up in a religious household. Like religion is a lot less ingrained in society in Canada. And so, you know, I think that really played a role as well.
Sure. Yeah, because I've talked to some sex researchers who, like, when they started doing sex research, it was almost like their awakening. And you're just kind of like, no, I was fine. Just it would have been like studying any other topic, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it was. Well, yeah, it really was.
Something else I've heard talking to some sex researchers is like the bias that the bias or prejudice sometimes you can face just studying your field. Have you faced any... backlash in the world of academia because of what you study?
In the world of academia, not as much. I would say like outside of the world of academia, perhaps not taken as seriously just because I'm a sex and relationships researcher, but most people who are within the field or not even who are within academia, like to go back to the biologists, like I feel like the respect gained from someone like a biologist is far greater than the respect that it might that someone might give who doesn't understand like how science is done or like, you know, a classic example of this is like if I tell someone, if I were dating and I told someone like, or in the early stages, like what I do, them sort of saying like, oh, are you just like studying me? And that's just like, that's not how science works. And so that just really gives you some insight into how maybe the public doesn't necessarily have a good understanding of what goes into scientific research. And that's on us as scientists to more accurately communicate that to the public. And then I think also with like grants, like grant funding really is disproportionately not provided to like the sex research field unless it's from a risk reduction standpoint. I think we're getting a little bit better with that with some like foundations kind of picking up some of the slack. But in terms of like governmental funding for this work, we're not getting that. Mm.
Does private funding like can private funding like kind of fill in the gaps for that, or is governmental funding so great that, you know, it's really necessary and nothing else can kind of really come close to it?
When it comes to working in a university system, governmental funding is really where it's at because the amount of money that the university brings in around foundation grants compared to governmental grants is quite a big difference. I'm always one to advocate for more funding coming to sex research. I mean, it's such an important part of our lives and of our well-being. Like it should be well-funded. But it's not.
Yeah, absolutely. It's insane that people go like, hey, we would like people to have better sex. And then everyone's like, no.
Yeah, I mean, but would they really, right? Like the question becomes like, would you really like people to have better sex? I don't know. It doesn't necessarily seem like that's something that's universally thought of as like a goal. And I think it should be.
I wonder if like y'all just I wonder if like the grant application phrased it that way. Like we want people to have better sex. End of sentence. Your fucking move, Joe Manchin. What are you? You don't want people to have better sex? Take that back to West Virginia. See how that plays. You fuck. Sorry. Wow, Joe Manchin hate this morning on Twitter. but these are things I've heard from a lot of academics over the years, like whether it's the funding problems or even just in the personal lives of people hearing that you even work anywhere tangentially to sexuality. And there's like this knee-jerk reaction to get like nervous about it or overly inquisitive and all that jazz. And it's like, why can't you just treat the sex researcher like the biologist, right? You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what was like the first, what was like your first sex researcher gig once you made that switch?
Well, I was in grad school for a really long time. So grad school, I guess. Like I went from undergrad, I took a year off and traveled a bit, and then I jumped right into grad school. And my undergraduate research thesis though was on romantic rejection, and it was looking at how people who have depressive symptomology react to romantic rejection from a stranger compared to people who do not have depressive symptomology. And so that was my introduction to kind of like relationships research a little bit. And then I went into a program, a master's program in Canada, and studied sexual satisfaction and sexual compatibility, and studied couples to see whether like their perceived compatibility compared to their actual compatibility predicted satisfaction differently. And found that it mattered. Your turn-ons and turn-offs don't have to be aligned, but your perception of being compatible with your partner really impacts satisfaction.
So being compatible was less important than just at least believing you were compatible?
Exactly. Yep.
Oh, so fuck. Where's my time machine?
Right. Yeah. You can have different turn-ons and turn-offs. Just you need to have the perception that you are compatible with one another.
Was there any factor of willingness to indulge the other person's turn on that you did not share? Did that play a role at all? Or
I didn't measure that, but that's, you're essentially talking about being GGG. So Dan Savage is GGG. Yeah. One of my colleagues and good friends studied that and did find that being GGG was beneficial for satisfaction in relationships. So, and for people who don't know what that is, being good giving in game.
Good giving and game. If you see it in someone's like, you know, Tinder profile, like that's probably a good swipe right to at least see. They're at least kind of trying to inform themselves.
Exactly.
And right now you're doing some studies around COVID-19. Is that the same study? Are you working with Dr. Justin Lehmiller on that? Or is that different? Oh, fabulous. We had him on earlier.
Yes, we are working on a study. We collected data over, we got right in there as soon as COVID hit and started collecting data. And we followed people over time. So we followed them over about 6 waves of data collection. And looking at just like how this craziness is impacting sex and relationships.
Mm-hmm. How many waves have you gone through since like November?
Have you done any more waves since then? April of last year and early April. And we continued through past Christmas. So actually, no, I think right before. So like early December is when our last wave of data were collected.
Okay. So do you have any conclusions yet, or is that something you're currently just looking at data and figuring out?
I mean, we've published one paper from it. Another one is under review right now, so I can talk about both of those. Like the one that Justin Lehmiller's first author on. So that was essentially showed that, you know, we found that there's people's frequency is decreasing, but for people who are still having sex, they're, willingness and
trying different things.
Yeah, they're trying different things. Yeah. There's more variety, which makes sense, right? Like, this is a really monotonous time. Like, sometimes I'm just like, what day of the week is it? Like, I just haven't left. Oh, when was the last time I left my house? You know? And so I think
my mom this morning was like, how's being snowed in? I was like, I was already quarantined in. There's no difference.
It's the same. Yeah. Right. At least now it's pretty out my window. I don't know. So yeah, it's just kind of, and so if you're on your own, then that's a really different experience too than someone who's quarantined with a partner. And I think we're also, so that's another trend that we're seeing in the data that we haven't published yet, that like I have seen in my preliminary analyses of like the different experiences for people in different contexts really matters. Like if you have little kids in the home, your experience is way different than someone, and like not to say that one's worse than the other, like they all have their downsides. This is hard for everyone.
So I went through a breakup like a few weeks ago, like back in early January. So I am going right now from having that every day, like I had a partner, and now I am just experiencing the loneliness and isolation that everyone else have been doing all year. So I'm actually just recognizing like how nice it was, like how good I had it. Like I had it really fucking good to like already have somebody that I could be with. I had a car so I could go to her place. I was able to stay there for periods of time. I was able to bring her here to Brooklyn. Like, and now I'm just in a basement in Brooklyn alone. Right. And it's like very different.
It is.
I'm like, yeah. I guess well, I gotta do TikToks
that,
now.
I hope that the knowledge that others have been enduring this helps you with your loneliness and sort of makes you feel better about it.
So, you know, Justin talked about the first paper when he was on back in the fall. Can you tell us more about this second paper?
Yeah, the other one is, it's looking at, couples typically have like expectations within a relationship, right? So some people tend to be more what we call, they have growth beliefs about relationships, meaning that they see their sexual relationship as something that will grow over time and that they will grow together with their partner in different ways that will facilitate satisfaction. And then other people hold what are called destiny beliefs, which means that they sort of think about sex in their relationship as like, we are just like really compatible and destined to be together. So that's always going to stay the same. And we are just like destined. It's sort of like people who believe in soulmates versus people who believe in, it takes work. So it's like a work model versus like a destiny model. So a growth model versus destiny. And so what I looked at is in our data is like, our couple, and this is only within the people who were at home during quarantine with a partner, do people who hold these more like growth beliefs, have they sort of been able to adapt to COVID-19 in a better way than in a more satisfaction promoting way than people who do not hold these growth beliefs as high or perhaps have higher destiny beliefs? And we did find. Go ahead.
Is that because inherent in the growth model there is adversity, whereas in the destiny model it's like it's written, it's Slumdog Millionaire, it's gonna happen no matter, like, it, you know, it's not supposed to be hard, it should just work.
Exactly. Yep. So what we saw is that people who do hold these growth beliefs were able to pivot a little bit easier, it seems, to like working through this really challenging time. Whereas people who hold these destiny beliefs, it's like, oh crap, like this is not how I thought this was going to go. This was not in the cards. Like, why aren't we just sailing through this if we're meant to be together?
We were going to get married in April.
Sure. Right. Like, and so then it can be quite a shock when these like issues arise. And this one in particular is just like something that none of us could have prepared for necessarily. And so it really, yeah, that's what we found, is that the people who hold these more growth beliefs are coping better with the stresses of the pandemic, and also their sex lives, the satisfaction of their sex lives and their relationships has been protected as a result of holding these growth beliefs. Whereas people with higher destiny beliefs seem to be suffering a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. And in both papers, you know, like what were your hypotheses like, and how are they lining up?
Yeah. That paper, for instance, is like really based in the theory of expectations in relationships. And so, when we base our hypotheses in theories, then we tend to see that typically they will show what we expect them to show. In that case, it was one thing that we didn't necessarily.
Did you just say you can't be wrong? Like,
well, you can be, because, like, for instance, one thing that we found, you're just less likely to be wrong when you're basing it in like a solid theory. definitely were wrong all the time. But one thing that I didn't hypothesize, because I wasn't too sure how this was going to play out, although I could have guessed that this would happen, but is that people who have little kids in the home, their sexual frequency is just a lot lower. And so that sexual frequency piece does play into satisfaction. Although for them, for people with kids, their relationship satisfaction wasn't as impacted by that decrease in sexual frequency. And so I think that's really interesting, like that. Yeah, it might be that you're going through this phase, but if you hold these growth beliefs, it's not going to necessarily impact your satisfaction really negatively, because you know that you're doing the best you can right now, and like you're working together toward something that's important to your life, right? Like survival of the relationship. And so I think that's really interesting that the kids didn't necessarily negatively impact relationship satisfaction. There was a little bit of a decrease in sexual satisfaction for people with kids.
But couples with kids, you know, they're kind of already used to the interruption of their sex lives because of the kids, right? So I've, you know, I feel like they're just like, well, this is just another thing getting in the way of us boning. But you know, like, sure, I feel like, yeah, they might be used to that.
Yeah, yeah. Depending on the age of the kids too, for sure.
What do you think the after effects of all this might be? What do you think? How do you think our relationships and our sexualities are they going to go back to where they were before? Do you think there's going to be a vast change? Are glory holes just going to like be around forever, or are the curtains coming down
have been around forever. I don't anticipate that to change, but
I mean, they weren't in my bedroom until this whole shit went down. So,
one of the things that I think we're all looking forward to this being behind us, right? Like, let's like get back to hugging in person and like not having to screen people for COVID before going on a date, right? But some things that I do think will come with us after this time might be, you know, the opportunity to utilize technology in ways that maybe we haven't before. Like, I feel like I've kept in really good. I moved across the country in the context of the pandemic from Kentucky to Minnesota. And, you know, it's a lot of things sucked about that, right? But the one thing that didn't was that there's, you know, before I moved, I was already hardly seeing my friends in Kentucky. And like, we were keeping in touch through like video chats and really just like increasing our communication through text and that kind of thing. So I think in relationships and in dating in particular, that utilizing technology in that way and like being able to really use it to our advantage for connection, I think that that's something that we will continue to do over time, mm-hmm, at a higher frequency than we were pre-pandemic.
I mean, I hope Zoom orgies don't become like a normal thing. I sat in on a couple and I was like, this is, you know, it's like it's novel, and I do not need this when this is all over.
Yeah, you had a far more eventful pandemic than I.
Well, because you know, all a lot of the communities were trying to adjust, like everyone did. I mean, comedy, you know, we had the comedy Zoom shows. You know, I saw play communities, like whether they're kink scenes or local sex party scenes, you know, have switching to virtual because they're like, we're not. There are some that are not switching to virtual, and like, I don't think people should go to those fucking parties when this is all over. Fuck those groups. But you know, there's a lot of these like Zoom things, trying to figure out, trying to make the best pivoting of it, being like, hey guys, we know this isn't how we normally like to fuck with each other, but like, let's just try it, because like, why not? So it's been interesting to watch. It's been interesting to watch the glitches. And I'm sure like it got, you know, a lot of places have gotten it smooth by now, but also it's like, ugh, it's just like a bunch of people like awkwardly watching each other like fuck or masturbate, and like constantly checking in like, I'm sorry, can you hear me? Am I muted? Sorry, no. Oh, it looks like you're moaning, but like either you have a Wi-Fi issue or I think you're on mute. It's like, it just takes, like, even when it starts getting sexy, like all the tech takes the sexy out of it.
Sure, yeah. And I do think another thing that we'll take with us then is the appreciation for, and I think we'll have like a new level of gratitude for like these in-person experiences, right? Like, I just think, I know for me, I'm going to be like so excited to like be out of the house. Like, it'll just be, I feel like it'll, once more people get vaccinated and things start to open up again, it'll just be a level of energy that we wouldn't have seen pre-pandemic because we didn't know what we were missing.
So, you know, the fucking, and Justin and I talked about this too, like the false headlines, the headlines written out of one line from an abstract that no one read, right? Then how in the beginning they were like, there's going to be a baby boom. And then it was like, there, baby boom's coming. It was kind of like GameStop having the squeeze. It's like, it's coming anytime, maybe never. And then the data showed that actually would be the opposite. So with that thought in mind, do you believe the baby boom will come after mass vaccinations, when people are just jumping out of their places to finally fuck and date and all that?
Yeah, no, I don't. I think baby booms, this whole like baby boom idea, I mean, the data that show previous baby booms can also be pretty criticized in like their ability to actually predict these baby booms. And I've said from the beginning, we're not going to see a baby boom in this context, in the context of the pandemic. Like, who wants to make a baby right now? I have never been more glad that I do not have a child, like ever. You know, it would be so much harder to have a child in the context of the pandemic, is no matter what age they are. Like, it's just like really, really would be really hard. And I have the majority of my friends are in that position, right? But so I don't think people were looking to do that. And then I think post, I think, yes, we will be very excited, but still, like, it's still a, I don't know, it's like, having a baby is a big deal. It's not like people
Well, it seems like a lot of these places, they try to take sexual frequency and like they tie that to birth rates
which
and
they
baby
shouldn't.
Booms. Right. Like, we're a more evolved people.
People have IUDs and like, like I know that, okay, well, I shouldn't say that everyone does because our access to birth, let me take a moment to just say like the access to birth control in the United States is really, really poor given what we, given our medical system and what we should have access to. But I do think like this idea of a baby boom coming from some sort of, it just doesn't pan out that way in my informed opinion.
Yeah. I wonder what that's about. I mean, like, it's incredibly heteronormative, but also just like really, it's really trying to like grasp onto this concept of like, we must populate the country. I don't know. Country's populated like a motherfucker. I don't know if we need to, but I don't know why the narrative always has to be, well, if we're having more sex, there's going to be more babies. Cause like, as you say, so not true, but it's always the headline. It's always the fucking headline.
Yeah.
It's gotta be so enraging to read headline. Have you read headlines about your work and you're just like facepalming?
Oh, for sure. I published a study in grad school that's like a classic example of that, where all the headlines were like, for men, once a cheater, always a cheater. For women, make sure they're satisfied. Like, it was like simplifying the results to the max. And I'm in grad school, so I'm seeing, and so like I wasn't as established as I am now, and so I'm like seeing this and like freaking out, like no, that's not what we found. It's not once a cheater, always a cheater. But that was what the media grabbed onto. So I've become like a lot better at the way that I communicate my scientific results to the media in general now. But it's really and especially like clickbaity type titles and that kind of thing is really frustrating.
Right, because it's like you don't expect the lay person to actually go read your study or even to go read an abstract, but like you know the job of news media should be to report news and not just turn everything into a think piece. And I feel like there's so much less of that, and the news reporting would probably hopefully be a more accurate portrayal of, say, your work than, you know, when Huffington Post does it or Cosmo, and they want to try to get the clicks versus inform anyone, you know, like, yeah. I would rather read a sex study article from the Associated Press than like anywhere else, because they're like not allowed to have anything. They're not allowed to be excited, right. Which is like a great thing. It's incredibly boring and it's good. I wish more people read boring things.
Yeah, but and like that's like why I write for Psychology Today, because I am a scientist and know how to digest it in that way. And like, or like Justin Lehmiller, you know, he's shifted his whole career to doing that translation piece. And I think that that's so helpful. Additionally, there are certain journalists who I have a really good relationship with, who I trust and can talk to about these things. And so like, when I do have a really exciting study, they're the first ones that I contact about it, because I trust them and we've built a relationship over the past decade, and like, they're going to get first dibs on it because they haven't done the clickbaity stuff.
Mm-hmm. Is there a particular study you've worked on that was like the most misrepresented in the media?
The one that I just told you about, that one? On infidelity. Yeah.
I would have imagined the bisexual ones would have got, because like, you know, anytime they can throw it into the, I think, again, it got me, because I was like, I started following you either because somebody retweeted you or probably because I saw like a headline that you know, said yeah. something, this. And I was like, oh, clearly, if I need to talk about, and listeners don't know, but it's like, I hit up, you know, Kristen and was like, want to talk, like, all about bisexuality. And you were like, that's barely what I do. And or it's only a part of what I do. And I'm like, oh, shit, there you go. The misrepresentation affecting yours truly.
Yeah, no, I think that study, you know, that study on bisexuality, what we did is we looked at, how bisexual individuals in the context of a mixed sex relationship. So like, it's not, you know, I'm bisexual, and whenever I'm in a relationship, I'm not, it doesn't mean that I become straight or I become gay, right? Like, I'm still bisexual. Like, so it's not a heterosexual relationship if I'm in a relationship with a man. And right. So we studied how that bi erasure, that's what we call that, how that bi erasure impacts people, not only the individual who identifies as bisexual, but also their partner. And we found that like their satisfaction was impacted when that bisexual identity felt more erased or didn't feel as celebrated. And so, yeah, there were definitely some media, there were some media coverage of one of the papers that came out of that study that sort of classified it as like, as those individuals not being monogamous in their relationship, and like, and so monogamy often gets thrown out in there. But in our sample, like 75% of the sample was in monogamous relationships, 25% were in consensually non-monogamous relationships. So, you know, the majority of bisexual people do, just like the majority of people, tend to lean toward monogamy. There are some people who lean toward consensual non-monogamy, and that's great, but it doesn't mean that you're bisexual, nor does it mean that all bisexual people are non-monogamous. So I think it's just like so many assumptions are made around that.
Right. There's a, you know, the assumption like, oh, well, bi people will cheat more. It's like, you know, hey, bi people cheat, straight people, every way, you know, a lot of different types of people cheat, but it's not like
25% of people higher cheat.
Propensity.
Yeah.
And there you go with that. Has there been any research you've done that has like surprised you and made you think about how it applies to your life?
So, you know, given studying something that is so personally relevant to everyone, like everyone can find some personal relevance to sex and relationships research, right? But I will say, like, in terms of my personal life, like, I really do, I am well practiced at this point in, like, not letting it really impact my relationships. And I think that is, sure, there are benefits in the sense that like I know how to communicate really well, and like if you are uncomfortable communicating about this sort of thing, like we're probably not going to be a good match. Like there are just, you know, there are some things that I feel like me and my relationships benefit from, but in general I don't really tend to, like, I feel like I kind of almost forget about it in the like there's a real separation between like what I'm doing and then like my actual life. I guess the same way that like an accountant isn't going to like spend their whole night thinking about their family's taxes when they like, you know what I mean? So I've done a lot of research in the area of sexual desire discrepancy, where one person's desire is higher or lower than their partner. And one of our like consistent findings in that research is that men and women are like equally likely to be the member of the couple with lower desire relative to their partner, despite the fact that societal stereotypes would tell us that like men have high desire, women have low desire. Like this is, you know, what we're supposed to expect. And so I think that was really helpful in that's been helpful, I think, across multiple relationships, just in not like learning not to take that sort of thing personally and knowing that there's like, that there are dynamics there that might not go the way that you expect them to, and to not hold people, like the extent to which holding someone accountable to stereotypes can be really harmful for satisfaction. And I think there was a long time, maybe in my younger years, where I would have like sort of used those stereotypes and talked to a partner, you know, talked about it in the context of the stereotype to a partner, as opposed to being like, no, like there's a lot of variation here and this is totally normal for you to feel this way. You know, I think that's one way.
So the more you learn, the more you know, you don't play into what's easy to say, the easy jokes, the easy assumptions, the easy roles to take. You know, it's, you know, people make jokes, like, you know, people would make, I'm a comic, you hear a lot of like hooker jokes, but then when you start to learn more about sex workers, you like those jokes will either stop being or they alter and become more informed and probably funnier because they're better informed, because they reflect reality better. It's fascinating when you just when you're exposed to more. It sucks because then you're like, you almost start holding yourself to a higher standard. I don't know if you've ever caught yourself like for some reason one of those stereotypes or assumptions like popping into your mind and almost having to check yourself, be like, no, Kristen, no, Billy, that is, we know, we have the data, we know that's not real. Like, we know that's fine. That helped me during all COVID to know that like libidos were going down because like mine tanked because like this is all fucking, I was angry at everybody nonstop going on social media and seeing people at a fucking party in April and May and all that. So it, you know, nothing makes you hornier than starting to hate the human race because you realize that they don't give a shit about one another. And that made me not very horny. And that also like carried into my relationship, which then had to have all these conversations. But I felt better when I knew it wasn't just me because the assumption is, oh, we're all locked up. We're all going to fuck nonstop. And I'm a guy, so I got to want to fuck nonstop. So sometimes like having that knowledge can be really comforting, at least for me.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think it's helpful for everyone like to know that that's – I think it also not only makes me hold myself to a higher standard, but also partners, you know? I think
Do you have any good stories of kind of checking a partner on something like that?
Oh, I'm sure
your face says yes.
I'm sure I have a. I am sure that they would love to talk about the ways in which I have have corrected, but I can't think of a specific example.
It is
I really
odd, though,
try you have- not to. I really try not to, but I'm. I have
you want to do the right thing, but you don't want to be a buzzkill, but like.
Right. Yeah. It's, I have strong opinions and yeah. I'm not afraid to share them. So.
That's dope. Yeah. let's say, okay. I don't know what the number is, whatever the big number is, that is a big number. I've got the big number of money. What's your dream study or grant? I'm giving you a blank check to do the one thing and study the one thing you really fucking want to do. What is it? What are we studying?
Yeah. Well, it would be a huge multifaceted study that would like look at a lot of different variables in a lot of different populations. So I think one of the things that we don't do very well in sex research is like have the ability to recruit from diverse populations in a way that is meaningful. Like so many of our studies are just based on like white straight people.
You're talking about the study participants or the researchers themselves?
The study participants, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the researchers themselves could also be a lot more diverse, but we're working on that, and I hope that we'll continue to see more diversity in researchers themselves. So I would want to do a study that, like, studies couples and includes, like, when I say diversity, I mean not just diversity in, like, race, ethnicity, gender. I also mean diversity in, like, sexual orientation and relationship orientation. So I would love to do, like, a massive, massive sex study. We could even market it as, like, the sex study.
Oh, I like it. I like it.
I'm picturing the logo now. And and then I would love to, like, follow couples over time or thruples or however, you know, and get a large enough sample within each of these subgroups to be able to make some meaningful comparisons. Because one of the – I have, like – for a long time, I've always tried to increase at least sexual and gender diversity in the context of my studies. It's harder. It has been harder traditionally for me to increase racial diversity. I think we have some work to do in like trust and like buy-in from ethnic minority communities to like get them to, you know, trust us. And that's mm-hmm. understandable. And so I'd like to see us work on that. So, but even though I have tried to make an effort in the area of like sexual orientation and gender diversity, inevitably in those studies, because they are not powered with enough money, I would say that's probably one of the main reasons, is like once we get down to like the comparisons that we can make, the statistical comparisons, our sample sizes are so small in those in those like dialed down cells that we can't make any of those meaningful comparisons. Yeah. So I think just like really increasing the diversity of the sample for one. And then in terms of like research questions that I would want to ask, like I want to know how are people maintaining desire in long-term relationships? And I have several, I mean, this would take a really long time for me to go through the entire study methodology. So I would like want to solve the world problems of maintaining desire in long-term relationships. And I would want it to be like an intervention research study where we had a control group and we have like couples who are going through different, you know, different arms of the study and getting different treatments. And I would love to include within that, not just aiming to maintain desire in long-term relationships, but what are the ways in which people can mitigate sexual desire discrepancy? And then for the couples who aren't in those longer-term relationships, because again, this is the sex study, so it is a large sample of people, some people who are in earlier relationships, I would love to understand like what are the ways in which, so we still have the top number one like problem is we rank number one in the world for unintended pregnancy here in the United States. And so we still have that as like a huge issue. And we also have higher abortion rates than some other countries who like have open access to abortion and like have open access to contraception and have, you know, all of these like really basic human needs. I think one of the reasons that we have the highest unintended pregnancy rates, have some of the higher abortion rates, et cetera, and have like lower access to abortion is because we don't acknowledge the role of sexual pleasure in the pursuit of sex at that age. So I'd like to be able to do like some intervention research around like desire, assessing desire discrepancy and maintaining desire in long-term relationships. And how does this look for these different types of couples, right? Like, so you're doing a comparison study with multiple different intervention arms. Additionally, because you have like such a huge sample, you have people who are younger and who are maybe navigating like pregnancy prevention or STI prevention, or like they're navigating some of these risk reduction pieces that are important, but get so focused on. So I would want to include some interventions related to like pleasure and talking about pleasure with younger people so that we can really, So it would kind of be like this massive study with like these two different intervention pieces, one targeting couples who are in established relationships, one arm targeting like younger people who are navigating new relationships. So it would kind of be like multiple studies in one, but since you're giving me all the money, then I want all the money and I'm going
to
do all
Kristen, the things. If I didn't live in a basement in Bushwick, I want to give you all the money to do all the research. I live in a basement in Bushwick.
Maybe one of your listeners like is just like a billionaire and can just send me a check. That would be amazing. I'm happy to talk.
That would be fantastic. If I have a billionaire listener, one, make sure you are on my Patreon. And then two, you need to go fund this woman, right? So she can change the world.
Exactly. And so I just do want to like nail home the point that like by not acknowledging that sexual pleasure is one of the main reasons that we engage in sex, like we are leaving young people surprised that sex feels good, right? Like that is such a missed thing that, yeah, it just is, it's, we need to be integrating these like pleasure-based messages in our messages about sex to young people. And then also, I mean, just like not talking about sexual pleasure, one of the main reasons that people don't engage in correct and consistent condom use is because they think that it decreases sexual pleasure. Well, we need to talk about then how do we integrate pleasure-based approaches to condom use, right? Like, why are we not using, and people are, like I say, why are we not? There are great researchers doing this work, and like I've been part of some of those teams over the years who are doing some of this work, and it's such important work. It's just, it's like not trickling down into the public in as speedy of a way as we really need it to be able to make the difference in society at large. And I think that if I had an unlimited amount of money, I would want to like make that difference in society at large. Mm-hmm. That like sex feels good and that's great. Like, let's get rid of the shame. Let's get rid of the guilt. That's a societal shift that will take a long time to happen, but you know, like let's acknowledge this and then we can improve the ways in which we engage in risk reduction through pleasure.
And money funding is that's also part of the reason why so many of these studies tend to be just with like college age kids. Like I imagine with like a higher budget, you can afford to like really solicit and do outreach to a like adults, college kids, you are adults legally, but not really. So it's like, if we can study like couples who are in their 30s and 40s and 50s, as opposed to only couples in their early 20s and late teens, I would imagine that's more helpful.
Yeah. And also I think, like, you know, having the resources, financial resources, to power some of these studies in a larger way helps to get people from all of those age groups, right? Like, most of my studies have been of couples who have a mean age of like 35, and like, I'm essentially sampling my demographic. Like, you know, this is just what happens when you don't have a huge amount of money to recruit in a systematic way, and instead you're relying on like convenience sampling, which is not nearly, like, I would love to make some of these studies like nationally representative, or like internationally representative would be even better, to have that match happen on demographics.
And I forget if it was Justin who brought this up or somebody else, but another part is people who participate in a sex study typically have maybe more healthier views, or more active healthier views of sex, or more active sex lives. And how can money be the answer to get people who are a little more closed off about sex, a little more nervous about sex, or even a lot less people who are less active about sex but also have shame about, like, how do you tap into those communities? And is money the answer, or is it messaging?
Yeah, money is the answer. I mean, that we can, so for instance, we're about to launch a daily electronic report study. We have a bit of money to do so, and we're able to recruit then people from using an online service that they recruit for you. And the people don't necessarily know that they're participating in a sex study. They are just being recruited into a survey. And so
part of it is hiding the nature of the study. Well, if you're trying to tap into that world.
So that gets into like ethics of it. So we never hide what we're doing once they click on, like, once they get invited by this organization, and they're going to be paid, right? So there's like that incentive. You need to have some sort of an incentive to participate, especially for people who aren't comfortable talking about this stuff, which is the target audience. And so we do need to, though, tell them in the context of their consent form, like, here's what you're participating in. You know, this might make you feel uncomfortable. Here's some resources in case it does. We're not going to ask you to do anything. We're just going to ask you to, you know, it'll just be part of the study protocol that these questions happen to have to do with sex. And so we do need to disclose that in the consent form for ethical reasons. And I think that's really important for us to do, right? I don't want somebody participating and being like, whoa. But the initial recruitment of, like, the initial getting somebody to participate looks a lot different in those studies that are powered by money and you can pay every single participant than the ones that we post that we might, like, recruit participants through snowball sampling. Another way, like, couples, for instance, like, I don't know about you, but when I'm in an unsatisfying relationship, the last thing I want to do is spend 20 minutes answering a bunch of questions about my relationship. Right? Like, that's not fun. Like, you're just like clicking through and you're just like, wow, yeah, this really does suck. Okay, confirmation here. Like, so that's
why. Did you tell Kristen we were having a good time? Did you tell her that? Because I don't think that's true. That could start a whole nother fight.
Right. Like, so. It's hard to get couples to participate in these studies unless they're satisfied. So what makes them participate? Well, we gotta finance that. And that allows for us to get couples who maybe aren't as satisfied. And also, you know, we offer other incentives, things like, we'll give you a report at the end that, like, gives you some tangible things to do in your relationship. Like, you know, here's like a little mini therapy package that you can do at home with your partner. And here are some ways in which this is targeted to your relationship. And so we've done that in studies before, too, in order to...
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, in order to try and promote more participation. But again, that takes, like, manpower. That's, like, it's really, really intensive hours that it takes to put that sort of thing together. But it's such a valuable resource for a couple. Like, imagine just getting, like, this personalized packet sent to you that's, like, here's your personalized therapy packet.
That is really cool. I did not know that was an incentive that can be given out. Dr. Kristen, Mark, this was great. Thank you so much for making time for me. Thanks for chatting with us. I feel like I have learned a lot. I hope my listeners have as well. Where can people go to learn more about you, learn more about your work, write you a big ass blank check?
Ooh. Yeah. So I can be reached on my website. It's just kristenmark.com, but I'm also... my new position.
Yours is Kristen with an E-N, yes, I think we should say, right?
Kristen with an E-N, K-R-I-S-T-E-N-M-A-R-K. But I just started this new position in the beginning of January at University of Minnesota Medical School. So I'm the new Joycelyn Elders Endowed Chair for Sexual Health Education there. And, you know, we have like lots of programs and we have a sex therapy clinic and... So checking out that website as well and just looking at like University of Minnesota's medical school and our program in human sexuality, you can learn a lot on our website and see all of our offerings, and my email address is there and you'll find me under the director of education there.
Fabulous, fabulous. Well, thank you again for chatting with us, and why don't you go ahead and say goodbye to everybody?
Okay, well, thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun.
Woo-wee! What did you think about this week's show, everybody? Let me know your comments, your questions, your criticisms. Send it all on over to manwhorepod@gmail.com. Did you have thoughts about this week's episode? We would love for you to join the chat about it in the Champagne Room, which is our totally free, public, sex-positive, and supportive and fun Discord server. There will be a channel dedicated to episode 372 in there where you can talk all about the sex research that you want. There's a link in the show notes, but join us over there at manwhorepod.com/discord. And I'm doing the talks and the ticks. I'm doing the TikToks. I'm trying. And it's I hate that I'm having fun, but also it feels like a fucking job. I've been dropping like some step videos over on the TikTok. I feel like you would like to see that other side of me. It's a side that I can't show you on a podcast very much. So over there at the TikTok, I'm at TheBillyPrasita. All my other social media, they're in the show notes. You can check them out. Search Billy Prasita. I'm sure you're going to find me pretty easily. And you can also easily find me with less clothes and a way sexier tone of voice on my OnlyFans, which you can follow for free. Head on over to OnlyFans.com/callmebilly. Don't be shy. Say hello. Let's have some fun. Probably seems a little bit inappropriate to segue from an OnlyFans plug into this, but and I want to give a shout out right now to all my listeners, especially in Texas, but not just in Texas. I know a lot of y'all got hit hard by that snow that you're not used to, or maybe we're not prepared for. Oklahoma, Louisiana, Kansas, Missouri, all y'all, I'm so sorry you're hurting. Hope you're getting the aid and help that you need. Stay safe, stay warm. If feasible, stay slutty. Tax season is coming up, everybody. It ain't sexy, but it's necessary. And for years, I have been filing with BrassTaxes.com. Yep, they offer tax help for freelancers, artists, and as their website calls it, other nice people. The sooner you schedule your first appointment, the cheaper it is to file with them. So if you don't feel like you've been getting your money's worth out of quote-unquote free tax applications, head on over to BrassTaxes.com and schedule a consultation today. Let them know Billy Prasita sent you. I'll get a little bit on the back end. BrassTaxes.com. Let's get to the show.